Hi, my name is Ben Armstrong.
Hi, this is David Koch.
My name is Thomas Maurer.
Hi, I'm Donna Sarkar.
Hi, my name is Lana Montgomery.
Hi, I'm Seth Warres.
Hi, I'm Aaron Thomas.
I'm Jess Dodson.
Hi, I'm Rocky Heckman.
Hi, I'm Sonia Cuff.
Hi, I'm Troy Hunt.
Hello, this is Wally Mead.
My name is Reid Purvis.
Hi, I'm Lars Flynn.
Hi, my name is Alan Birchall.
Hi, I'm Adam Fowler.
Hi, I'm Sky Guthrie, and you're listening to the Need to Know podcast.
All the latest Microsoft Cloud news, as well as industry guest deep dive conversations. It's the Need to Know podcast, all thanks to Rode Microphones. The Need to Know podcast. Catch us on Twitter and Facebook, NGK Podcast, and online at podcasts.needtoknow.cloud.
Welcome along to this Need to Know podcast. We're at episode 195, fast approaching 200. And as always, my co-pilot on this adventure to at least 200 is Brenton Johnson. Welcome, Brenton.
Good to be back, Robert.
So we've decided to try something a little bit different today. Do you want to explain to the listeners what we're trying to be a bit sophisticated about now?
Yeah, so for a while now, we've been recording our podcast in Skype for Business, which has been working quite well. Before that, we had an open source alternative where we're using Audacity. We're recording the audio on both sides separately, and then I was sending the audio file in a WAV format, which is 300 meg, to Robert, and then he'd use some other program to mix it all together. Then we moved to the Skype for Business, where that was really quite seamless. We just log into Skype for Business. He'd send me a meeting invite. When we're ready to go, he hits record, and off we go. And now we've taken it to the next generation, and we are now doing a Skype for Business across tenants in Microsoft Teams. So Robert's in his tenant. I'm a guest in the tenant, which is also quite exciting. I've got some more news around that that listeners of last week's podcast would know already about. But yeah, that's what we're doing. And so far, the user experience has been quite nice. We've set up a scheduled meeting. Robert's pushed down a Teams link. It comes out. It looks a lot nicer in the calendar. And then when he was ready to go, he pushed through that phone call to me, and it started ringing on my phone, on my PC, and my Surface. It was a bit sort of disorientating, but it was really good. And then all I had to do was answer it. So it wasn't, I have to find the link in the email somewhere and I can't find it and whatever. He pushed that straight into my Teams, went ring, ring, and I answered it, and it was great. So that's what we're doing this week. So I'm quite excited about it, and it seems to be so far so good, Robert.
So let's see, early days yet, but I'd be really interested to see what feedback we get from the listeners, especially when it comes to the audio quality. Now, obviously that may change as we produce it and obviously make it compact as we can to get it out to people, but I mean, if there is a noticeable difference, I'd really like to know, because apparently, like I said, the Teams has better codecs than the Skype for Business or anything else. So if you do notice something, a noticeable improvement or a change in the audio quality, whether good or bad, please let us know so that we can obviously evaluate this. Again, we're doing this in Teams for the first time. So again, there might be a little bit of bumps along the way till we get the exact settings that work, but hopefully it's not too difficult to get it working given our Skype experience. So again, give us some feedback. Let us know if the audio quality has changed at all. And again, we will adjust as we go along, but this seems like the new and the best way to do it, given that Skype will eventually be rolled into Teams. So as soon as we start doing this, the better it would seem. Now, the idea for today is just to give you a brief rundown, a couple of news items, and then we're going to jump straight into an interview. I'm going to make Brenton so excited. If he's excited now, you just wait till I tell him who the guest is going to be for this episode. So who do you think, Brenton? Who do you think that I've gone out and selected to be your guest of this podcast that's really going to get you excited?
Oh, I bet it's Satya Nadella. You just rang him up, Robert, and said, I'm an MVP from Australia, and I really like what you've been doing with Microsoft. Will you come on the podcast? I'm sure he said yes.
So that's quite a funny statement there, Brenton, but I am being serious. Who would it be?
Who could it possibly be?
Let me give you a hint. It is your favorite MVP.
Ah, Troy Hunt.
That's the one.
Ah, nice. Yeah. I like Troy. I listen to Troy every week. I listen to his weekly.
I did an interview with Troy, and we talked about one of the suggestions you had about serverless compute and how he runs Have I Been Pwned? So his security website, how he's able to optimize that and get things to run basically using Azure Functions. So we've got that interview for you as soon as we finish our intros here. So probably with that, we probably might as well throw into your first story there, given that we're sort of tying into the whole Skype goes Teams motif here. So what's your first bit of news for us?
Well, recently I got an email from Microsoft saying that they're retiring Teams. Teams is over. Teams is the old, not Teams. Skype is the old money. And Skype for Business is now getting rolled into Teams. So it said, you're getting migrated at some time in the future. It didn't specify when. And then it sent me a link to a whole bunch of Microsoft resources around, this is what Teams is. This is how it works. This is how Skype for Business will look in Microsoft Teams. Here's the admin's guide to migrating your Skype for Business people into Teams. Here's all of that information. So I went in there and dug around for a bit. I found this one article that I think summed it up really well. It's a bit of an old article now. It's over a year old, but it's named A Vision for Intelligent Communications in Office 365. And as I've played more and more around Team, I've been writing up a training proposal to go and do some Teams training for a company. So I'm getting really boned up on it at the moment. I think this, what they're really talking about is, at the moment, organizations are still heavily reliant on email to really get their work done. This is a technology invented in the 1970s, and it's still the go-to productivity tool of the enterprise. And now we're moving into a modern productivity tool, which is Teams, and it's really doing a lot of this stuff for us. So I found that article. I have a bit of a read of it. I thought it was quite a good one if you just need to get your head across the concept. But there is endless content. Microsoft's really being supportive of helping people move from Skype for Business into Teams. And as you can see, Robert and I are already onto it. And I can say the audio quality on my end from listening to Robert on many a Skype for Business webinar. So now I think it's just a little bit better on my end.
Excellent. All right. Well, I've got an article here basically on the updates to Microsoft Teams for November. So again, keeping on the Teams theme, there's a lot more third-party integrations. So they're integrating now with things like Confluence, Meecan, also Jira Cloud, and the Poly app has also been updated as well. Brenton's article there also talks about the concept of coexistence. So again, this article that I've got for you, we'll also give you some links off to that to start exploring that. So coexistence mode will allow you to continue to run Skype and Teams together and hopefully interoperate better. But down the track, remember, as we've said, the Skype is going away, being rolled into Microsoft Teams. We've also got the ability now to do our Teams membership based on dynamic group membership. So that means that you could put you could put an attribute in your directory, and you could then use that as a rule to create dynamic membership and add people in and out and assign licenses. We've also got the org-wide team that we spoke about. So you can now create an organizational-wide team across your whole organization. That means that all members will be obviously part of that team. So again, have a look at that. We've got some additional configuration you can make around scoped directory search. And we've also got a bunch of new features in iOS and Android. So one of the really cool features I think now is the ability to set your quiet hours. So you can set quiet hours and quiet days now in the mobile app for iOS and Android. We've also got the ability to look at the organizational information, and we can also do a lot better when we go to schedule meetings. But I think probably the biggest benefit that I've seen, or what the thing that I really liked the most, was this new driving mode. So again, the benefit of Teams is we can have a Teams meeting, we can share our video and our audio directly on our phone, and typically a lot of people probably be doing that in the car, maybe when they're moving, so we want to make sure we're as safe as possible. So again, Teams now has a driving mode in the mobile app. So if you haven't played with Teams on the mobile side, it is really good. And again, I've used it, for example, to have when customers go out into the field and they're looking at work, they can take video and either record it and share it with everybody. So handy little features. And again, it just indicates that Teams is really, really adding heaps and heaps of features. So again, like I said, we've decided to dive in and start using it as well, haven't we, Brenton?
Oh, for sure. And it's a sexy little app too. When I'm sitting there playing with it, I'm making messenger calls on Facebook to people and I'm using Teams to call people. It feels like a mobile phone experience. So as SMS has basically disappeared as a tool and moved into messaging apps, I think this will happen for voice and video as well. Video was never really in that world, but you know, certainly voice will move into these apps. And having a Teams app that everybody has installed on their mobiles, for example, because they need it for work, and being able to instantly call people and then have a 3 or 4-way conversation all in the power of your mobile, this is really what we're talking about when we're talking about the benefits of having the mobile app. And if you have a look at the article here, they've got a really good iOS example where it just looks like somebody's ringing you. So the integration is actually there in iOS, so it looks really nice. And they've also got a couple of customer stories in the bottom of this blog post as well that you should check out. One from Telstra, which people might have heard of before, and also Qantas Airways. So jump in there and have a look at those two Australian examples.
Cool. All right. So some other quick news while we're at it, so that we can get you up to date before we jump into our interview with Troy, is that one of the things that I have certainly been advocating for people to consider is the fact that Windows Defender, I believe, now is as good, if not better, than many of the third-party options out there. Where I think it wins is its integration, the ability to deploy it using things like PowerShell and also integrate with the higher-end enterprise Windows Advanced Threat Protection, or ADP. There is basically a story here that, again, indicates how Defender has performed, and it's done very well, in the latest round of AV tests. So, again, unfortunately, Windows Defender, like many Microsoft products, probably had a very poor name initially when it came out, didn't receive a lot of love, was just thrown in for free. But now Microsoft certainly have focused on it, really improved it. And like I said, I believe it to be as good, if not better, than what's out there. And again, this integration, I think, wins it over. So I'll put the link to the AV test or the document there that you can go and have a look at and do some comparisons. Certainly, I would recommend that it's be given some consideration if you're looking to work out what the best AV is for your environment. And the last one I threw in here, just as a bit of a change up, is to, again, a link here on getting started with machine learning. So it seems that every time we turn a corner, or every time you read something, or every time we go to the web, we're basically bombarded with AI, machine learning, and so on. So I think I read a stat somewhere that the Australian government or the business in general is looking for something like 25,000 graduates, and a lot of those it's looking for in machine learning, AI, and that. So it's certainly an industry that has a great demand for it at the moment. And you can do that with Azure, and the article we'll put in there will hopefully get you started or get you be able to understand a bit better what machine learning is. So plenty of opportunity in that sort of space, I think, and it's something that everybody will need to consider when they're in IT. There's certainly everywhere you turn, it's AI, AI, AI. So I don't know what you see out there, Brenton, but it's certainly what I'm seeing.
Oh, yeah, AI is massive. Blockchain is massive. Blockchain is a bad wrap, but you know, blockchain in Azure. I went to the Microsoft summit, and when I had a look at that, I was just blown away with what you can do in Azure. Out of the box today, you can build an enterprise blockchain solution, and it's 90% done for you. We have a startup in our co-working space here, and he's built a whole app on the back of Azure Media Services. He says, you know, this for his sort of customers, they don't want a YouTube solution or a Facebook solution. They want a proper business grade, enterprise grade video broadcasting solution. So he's built it up in Azure Media Services. So you'd be just surprised once you open up the lid of what Azure can do. It's really a question of what can't Azure do more than what can it do. It's a great one to have a look at if you can get a chance to jump in there and get your head around it.
All right, so we don't have much time until we pop in our interview. Did you want to mention your sign up to my little program there and what you've seen so far?
Yeah, so I'll let everyone know on the podcast, I do keep my promises. I have signed up to the CIOps Patron program.
Patron.
Okay, patron program. So I am now a patron, which is really cool. So I've got access to the whole Office 365 codex. The main advantage for me is I get to have a look at all the links Robert's going to put up before the podcast, so I know exactly what he's going to spring on me and be more prepared. I also get to, there's just so much stuff. I can't believe it. I'm just sort of peeling off the layers now. There's a Teams that's in there, so I'm in there having a look at how that works. So that's really cool. Practical example, industry Facebook events. Facebook groups being good. That's been pretty full on. You know, Robert's
access
got access
to the recordings of all the webinars.
Yeah, I haven't really gone too much into that, but
and free for the month of November. Well, if you sign up today at www.ciapspatron.com, a free YubiKey. So everybody who does sign up for this month, again, we'll send you a free version 5 YubiKey, which I have those on order. They're coming from the US, and at this stage, we expect them to hit our shores in December. So that's an added bonus as an incentive if you sign up in the month of November. So again, thanks, Brenton, for signing up, taking advantage of all the resources. And again, I'm sure you'll give us some feedback. And again, the idea is how this can continue to be improved and provide information for IT pros and those people who want to be across the Microsoft Cloud, Office 365, and Azure as well. So I'm sure that we'll get a further update as we go along. But before we throw into our interview, one last little piece of further excitement for Brenton. Now, after Troy Hunt, which I'm sure will certainly make your day, I have also managed to secure an interview with an exclusive celebrity who used to be an MVP and also used to be the host of this podcast. Any guesses?
Is it Mark?
That's the one. So, again, following our interview with Troy Hunt, we'll get Mark Keane back on to talk a little bit about his journey, where he is now that he's working with Microsoft, what that's been like for him. And then we hope to get him back again to do some deep dives into Azure. So certainly plenty of listening for everybody, and I think special needs made to be mentioned for Brenton as well. So we made sure that we got those two interviews ready for them to make sure that he's really focused in this new environment now that we're recording in Teams. But I think with that, what I'll do is I'll leave Brenton maybe to let everybody know how they can get in touch with us here at the Need to Know podcast. So if you can let them know how they could do that, Brenton, that'd be great.
Okay. If you need to send us feedback, feedback@needtoknow.cloud. If you want to contact us, Robert's Director CIA at Twitter, and I'm Contact Brenton. You can also use Bing and find our respective websites. That's not too difficult to do. And I think there's always one thing that I miss, so I'll let Robert pick that up.
So N2K Podcast on Twitter and N2K Podcast on Facebook is also the community that you'll find around this. Don't forget the show notes will go to my blog, blog.ciaops.com. And we'll make sure that that gets out to you shortly as soon as we've produced this episode. Hopefully, fingers crossed, everything's worked well and the audio's come out. We can tack this on the front of Troy's interview and get the episode out really quickly to you. But I think with that, I'm ready to hear from Troy. What about yourself, Brenton?
Yeah, can't wait.
So welcome back to returning guest on the Need to Know podcast. Troy Hunt, welcome back.
G'day, mate. Thank you for having me back. Is this episode 3 for me?
I think this is, yeah, number 3. You're getting up there with the all-timers that return to the podcast. So it's really appreciate your time. But for those people Excellent. Who probably haven't listened to the previous two episodes, which they should do, mind you, do you want to give us a brief intro into who Troy Hunt is and what you do as a day job?
Oh, boy. I've got to work on my elevator pitch, actually. So what I do as my day job is a whole bunch of information security-related things. So I do a combination of a lot of online training with Pluralsight. I travel and speak a lot, too much. I run a lot of workshops for people. And I run Have I Been Pwned, which I think is actually now the thing that is becoming better known than me. So maybe that's what I need to lead with in my pitch.
It would sound so. I think that you'll have to get people, you have to tell people how you spell it, because again, that's maybe a bit of a difficulty for some people. But give us a bit of an idea of what is Have I Been Pwned? What's the benefit of using your service?
Right, so this is an elevator pitch, which is a little bit easier, actually. Have I Been Pwned is a data breach aggregation service. So when we see a data breach happen somewhere and the data gets spread out all over the place, I grab that data, I aggregate it into one location, and I make it searchable. So the value proposition for people is that they can figure out where their data has been exposed on the web.
Okay, so can I just ask a question on this? Where do you actually get this breach data from? Now, obviously, I know it's floating around there somewhere on the internet, but is it always in, you know, badhacker repository.com or something? Is it something you've got to search for? Or is it, how do you, you know, actually get your hands on this stuff? I suppose if you can basically give us a bit of insight into actually how you obtain this.
Well, security companies would like you to think it's all on the dark web. That's the first thing. So I got a little bit of a bugbear with this, where whether it's security companies or the press often refer to all this being on the dark web. And I think the dark web sort of creates certain emotions in people that makes it seem extra scary. And, oh, I got to protect myself because of the dark web. So I think people get a little bit carried away. The reality of it is that it's in all sorts of different locations. And one of those locations is simply sitting out there on the clear web. There are repositories that you can go to in your browser sitting on domains or IP addresses which just have hundreds, if not thousands, of different data breaches sitting there available publicly for anyone to download. And it still kind of blows me away. Many of these have been there for years as well. So that there's those, and those are in sort of fairly broad circulation. There are other incidents which are less well known. So, for example, if someone breaks into a system, rips all the data out of it, let's say it's LinkedIn, because it's a good example. So they might rip all that data out of it. LinkedIn doesn't necessarily know about the incident, or they didn't know about the scope of the incident at the time, the scale of it. So someone's using that data to either compromise people's other accounts where they've reused passwords, or phish them, or even just spam them. And what that tends to happen then over time is that as the value of that data goes down, it becomes more mainstream. People start reselling it. So I'm going to put it up on a dark web forum. I will say dark web there. Put it up on a dark web forum or a marketplace somewhere and actually try and monetize it. And eventually a few people buy that, and then it sort of starts to spread into broader circulation. So in many cases like that, another one that tends to happen quite a bit lately is there are lots of incidents of people standing up very large amounts of data in publicly facing services and inadvertently leaving it publicly accessible. So for example, we've seen a lot of MongoDB, publicly facing network segment, which is probably your first problem, and then not having a password on it. We've seen a lot of AWS S3 buckets exposed, consistently standing personal data up there. In fact, let me clarify that. These are organizations in many cases that have improperly secured their own infrastructure, but it contains a bunch of personal data related to their customers. And very often it's the likes of security researchers who come across that data, and many of them then send it on to me and it becomes searchable and Have I Been Pwned?
Okay, well, that makes it easy when people send you the search data. That's very handy. So obviously we would, I'd certainly encourage people to go and sign up to your service, run their email address through your service, and get notified as to whether their email address, which it probably has been, is somewhere in a data breach. Obviously make sure we've got different passwords for our different services, because we don't want to reuse our passwords. That's where we get an issue. But what we want to cover, I think, more so in this episode is really the back-end plumbing here for Have I Been Pwned? Because obviously it's now consuming huge amounts of data. It's becoming very popular, getting lots of requests. Obviously, when there's a breach, there's going to be a spike, you would think, in traffic. So what I've sort of invited Troy on here to speak about is how he's architected the back-end and how he's done that cost effectively in Azure. So can you give us basically a bit of an intro or an overview of, you know, what's behind the scenes here with Have I Been Pwned?
Yeah, look, it's a good question. And I guess for a sense of chronology, Have I Been Pwned came about in late 2013. So we're really going on 5 years old at the time of recording here. And if we think back 5 years, we had Azure. I'm not going to succumb to the American Azure. It's Azure, damn it. I'm not sticking with it. So Azure had been around for a little while in various forms. And in fact, it was interesting. Just yesterday, I decommissioned another service that I had built and maintained before this. It was one called a Safer Web, which used to do automated analysis of the security configuration of ASP.NET apps. And in that blog post, I was sort of commenting that I was running a Safer Web on the AppHarbor service. And AppHarbor had this mantra when they launched of Azure done right. And it's funny, you go back through our archive.org and have a look at that. And yeah, a couple of years after that, it dropped off because Azure finally started doing things right. But it had a solid foundation in that claim, and that in the early days of Azure, we had things like worker roles, which really weren't commensurate with just picking up an existing website and dropping it over into Microsoft's cloud. It posed all sorts of barriers to entry. But by the time we got through to the period where Have I Been Pwned was born, we did have the app service in Azure. So originally I stood Have I Been Pwned up on the app service as an ASP.NET web application using web API for some API calls as well. And then behind that, the data repository was primarily table storage. So when Have I Been Pwned launched, it had about 155 million records in there from data breaches. And I wanted a data storage construct that was fast to query by email address or by domain, because you can do domain searches. But I also wanted something that was cost effective. And it also had to scale as well, because, and mind you, I didn't really know it at the time, but Have I Been Pwned does get some pretty crazy traffic spikes at times. So table storage is really good for that, because it's just a really cheap sort of key value pair repository. You have a partition key, you have a row key, and then you can have a certain number of attributes off the end of that. So all of the data went into there, and well, actually, I'll rephrase it. All of the breach data went into there. There is a relational database that sits behind Have I Been Pwned as well, and it's just a SQL Azure, SQL as a service instance. And I can keep that pretty small because it doesn't actually do a lot. So for example, when people register for notifications, so you can go and put your email address in and then I'll tell you if I see you somewhere in a data breach later on. When you register, it goes into the RDBMS. And the reason for that is that I do all sorts of queries on that, and an RDBMS is great for doing relational queries, but it's an expensive beast if data gets really, really large. So I effectively sort of set that up from the beginning to use multiple different data structures that were either cost effective or performance effective or query effective, depending on the nature of the data that I was needing to work with.
Yep. Okay. So can I just a quick one? How do you get the data into the table storage? Do you have to write a custom migration thing, or does it come in the right sort of format? I mean, is that what that would to me would seem a little bit onerous to get the actual data in the format that you've created for the table storage?
Hey, wouldn't it be nice to say to hackers, hey, when you hack this site, could you please put the data in a nice format for me? Make my job easier. Look, it's something which is still a bit more laborious than what I'd like, but the basic workflow works like this. So someone sends me data, and it is in one of many different possible formats. It might be CSV, it might be a MySQL database backup. I get a lot of those just due to the prevalence of MySQL. It might be other arbitrary database formats. It might even just be a list of email addresses if it's a security researcher that's found exposed data and they're trying to be as responsible as possible and not give me any other PII. So I get all these different formats. I've got a script that just goes through and regexes out all the email addresses. So my sort of first layer of processing is point the script at the data, get the email addresses. And now I've got a common format. So I've got anywhere from 1,000 to hundreds of millions of email addresses. So what I do then is I've got a script which will go through and start inserting those into table storage. And this, in fairness, is one of the most laborious parts of it. This can take multiple days when there's many hundreds of millions of records in one breach. Now, this is a script that runs in a VM. So I do spin up a VM and I run what is effectively just a console app in there. Let me go back a step because I'm sort of jumping ahead. When I get all this data, so I extract the email addresses out, I actually zip them all and I upload them to blob storage. And I've then got a web job that sits in the app service, which is effectively the service running the website. That gets triggered by blob storage, extracts the zip, grabs all the email addresses, and then it starts inserting them into the relational database. And then the relational database, it all goes into there for a couple of reasons. So number one is that when I do the notifications later on, I can just join between tables. So I can say, hey, let me go to my subscriber base. There's about 2.2 million subscribers at the moment. Join it on the X number of emails that I just uploaded. The intersection of that is my subscribers that have been in the given breach. So that gives me that list. I also then spin up web jobs that run in the app service that take slices of the email addresses and starts inserting them into table storage. And that the reason it's done like this is that I need to be able to spin up parallel instances of a process to do this. So web jobs was kind of neat for that. They're also cost effective because I was already paying for the app service. So the web job just spin up in the app service. I'm not paying for anything else. But beyond that, and I'm hesitating now because I'm rebuilding a bunch of stuff and never been home. It's also kind of clunky. And part of the thing that makes it clunky is that it's running in the app service itself. So whilst it's processing data, it's actually cycling up the CPU and the website, which then has a performance impact there and then causes it to scale and leads us into all sorts of other problems that I think we're going to talk about shortly that then get addressed by things like functions. So at the moment, there's a bunch of moving parts. I have this itch to look more at using Azure Batch to try and process that in a more sensible way. But frankly, one of the big problems is just inserting large volumes of data into table storage. You can't use merge because I've got to do conditional logic based on whether the record exists already or not. And that can be very, very time consuming. You know, like I said, I can end up waiting for days or something massive. If it's let's say 10 million records, it's probably just going to be an hour, no biggie. But the big stuff makes it hard.
Yeah, I think that's probably something that people may not be aware of is obviously the data can be all over the place. Getting it into a format and then getting it into the website obviously is a challenge, and that's where a lot of the technical expertise that you've developed is applied in that thanks to the resources that you've got. Now, one of the things we wanted to talk about was this concept of serverless compute. Now, that's obviously part of the offerings that you're using, but can you give us a bit of an introduction or a bit of a explanation as to, you know, what's serverless compute and what's the benefit that it provides a service like you've got?
Oh, I'm so excited about this. So this is something that's really cool. I guess just firstly as a theme, in all honesty, one of the key reasons I created Have I Been Pwned was that I wanted to play with Azure. I wanted to build a data breach notification service too, but I really wanted to play with tech and build some stuff. I wanted a hobby project that wasn't Hello World. And part of the enjoyment that I've gotten out of running Have I Been Pwned is to watch it get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, yet being able to keep the cost as low as possible. Now, one of the challenges that you have with scale is the underlying infrastructure needs to support it somehow. And the way that would happen, if I go back even about 6 months, the way that would happen is that if I suddenly had a whole heap of people come to the site at the same time, and everyone's searching, and Have I Been Pwned up to about 5.5 billion records now. So they're searching through 5.5 billion records. And there are times where I've had tens of thousands of people within the space of seconds descend on the site because it's been on TV or something like that. And what happens is they all start hitting this app service which ran the API. And the CPU starts spiking up and then autoscale kicks in because it says, hey, you're using more than X percentage of CPU over Y number of minutes. We're going to give you another instance. So autoscale kicks in. But only after things start to kind of run like crap. And then it says, all right, here's another instance. And now you've got this whole other instance, which you may or may not need. You know, maybe I only need 5% of it, but it'll pay for 100% of it. And then if it's enough traffic, then it scales again and again. And then the traffic can suddenly drop off. And you've got all these extra instances. And then you have to wait for cooldown. And then the whole thing was, it was kind of magical at the time. But as time went by, the sort of the penny that dropped for me was that this was very much like the scenario that cloud was meant to fix, that PaaS was meant to fix. You know, like we'd always talk about this paradigm of, oh, if you're running like on-prem in your data center, you have to buy servers that cover you for peak periods, but you're not going to be using them most of the time, and you've got to plan in advance, and you might not have enough, and then the performance goes down. And in many ways, this is what PaaS for me became. Now, it became that with a whole lot more flexibility than needing to order physical hardware, but it's the same sort of problems of always paying too much or not having enough resources. So what functions start to do, and we're now talking a serverless paradigm, which actually, let's define it, just to be clear. So, you know, when we have things like PaaS and Azure App Service, you have a logical server, and maybe it has 2 cores and 4 gigabytes of RAM. And as you start to consume all of that, you're going to run out and you're going to need another logical server. Serverless starts to go down the path of saying, let's just pay for executions of code. So for Azure Functions, you're paying based on the number of executions, and then for each one of those executions, how long do they take and how much memory do they use? So it's a very, very user pays model, much more so than any other cloud paradigm. You know, I mean, we always used to say, oh, PaaS is great because you just pay for what you need. Well, that still means you might be paying for an entire logical server and you only need 5% of it. Functions are truly pay for what you need. And the joy of them is that the principle of this sort of serverless paradigm is that as you get away from the logical underlying necessity of a server and you're only paying for executions of code, you can get a very linear scale. So if my traffic goes 1,000 fold over from 1 second to the next second, it shouldn't matter because there's just more functions being executed on this massive collection of Microsoft servers. So there are still servers under serverless, and I'm only going to pay on what's used. And what I'm finding with this is that it's just becoming massively cost effective, not just because I don't need to have all of this infrastructure sitting around that I'm not using it at capacity, but also because functions are just ridiculously stupidly cheap to execute. And this has totally transformed the cost of the service.
Okay, so when you're talking about running a function here, I mean, are we talking about seconds for a function? Are we talking about minutes? Are we talking about hours? Sort of what time period are your functions running to give us a bit of a context here?
Good question. Let's bring up the stats. So the first part of the answer is it depends, because I've got a lot of different things that run in functions now. The one that's probably going to be the biggest here in terms of executions is when you're searching for a breached account. So for example, if you go to the home page and do a search, and in fact, if you look at the dev tools, you'll see there's a request to a unified search API. So that is executing in an average of 64.6 milliseconds. So there's been about 1 million searches on that in the last 24 hours, average of 64.6 milliseconds. Got an odd spike here as well. I don't know what happened there, but something spiked up to about 2.3 seconds momentarily at 3 a.m. my time. So yeah, perhaps that was the underlying table storage having a little bit of a hiccup. But yeah, 64 odd milliseconds there. Now, I've also got functions for doing things like sending email. So when you send an email on Have I Been Pwned, and well, when you perform a function that sends an email. So for example, if you subscribe to a notifications, it sends you a verification email. That email gets dropped in a queue. Now, as of only a few weeks ago, that was then using web jobs, which run in the app service, to be triggered when there's a new item in the queue. Now, the value proposition of the queues is that I can respond immediately to someone and say, hey, thank you, I've sent you an email. I mean, in fact, I've just queued an email, it will be sent. But I get an immediate response. I'm not making SMTP connections while people are waiting or anything like that. So it drops it in the queue, and the web jobs were great because they were running in a service that I was already paying for, running the app service. You don't pay for web jobs. They run in something that you're already paying for. The problem was that if I loaded a big data breach, and let's say I have to send 100,000 email notifications to my subscribers, and now you've got web jobs running in the app service that are triggered 100,000 times, and each execution of it takes roughly a second, now you're starting to burden the web app again. So the web app's going to scale. After it gets slow, I'm going to have all the problems we just discussed before. So I moved all that into functions just the other day. So now every time an email goes into the queue, it's a function which gets triggered. And the joy of that is everything we discussed before in terms of only paying per execution. but it also sends a lot quicker. So those 100,000 emails before could have taken half an hour for Azure to go through and actually send via SendGrid. And part of the problem of that is that if someone went and subscribed to like a notification, whilst those emails were already in the queue, it would go to the end of the queue, and then they could be waiting like half an hour to get their verification email, which wasn't a positive experience. So before, I actually ended up having multiple queues. So I had one queue for notifications, and they're going to take a while. And then there was another queue for if you actually subscribe and you need to get an email, and that can happen immediately. So I kind of hacked around it. But now it's functions. And when I look at my function execution duration here, the send email function is running in 821 milliseconds at the moment, which is much longer than the other one. But hey, it does actually have to call out to an external service being SendGrid and actually send that email. So it takes a little bit longer, but again, it's sort of happening in this independent serverless environment and not burdening anything that slows down the performance of the primary application.
Okay, so how do we go about creating these functions? Are they something we need to write code? What sort of level of code? How involved is it to actually go and create a function? So basically, do we do need to be a dev to be able to do this?
Look, I'm going to say yes. Someone else might come and say that there's some shiny, fancy, wizzy-wiggy, draggy-droppy thing that I have not seen, but certainly my experience of functions, even from the very early editions, which were a little bit clunky, you actually had to go and drop code into the Azure portal, through to the experience today where the tooling's actually quite good. You can just drop into Visual Studio and say, look, I want a new function. You are writing code. But one of the sort of joys of functions is they kind of deconstruct and decouple a lot of the applications such that a function can just be one atomic, very, very simple little piece of code. You know, some of my functions are probably only a dozen or so lines long. For example, I might have functions that are triggered on an HTTP request, and they just have to say, hey, go to table storage, get a record, and then return it. So they can be very, very simple as well. But you are writing code, and you know, the whole sort of premise of serverless is paying per executions of code, and you've got to write that somehow.
So, again, we've got the functions here. We've coded them up. We basically need to trigger those on events. How do the triggers happen? Is that something we do in the portal, or are we looking for something that's monitoring jobs? How do we actually trigger the function to actually kick it off and execute the code that we've written?
So that's something that you're defining programmatically. So if I go and I have a look now at my code, which is right in front of me, I have an HTTP trigger for many of my functions. So literally the method which invokes the function is decorated with an HTTP trigger, which says, hey, this can be triggered anonymously. We don't require any auth. It can be triggered by a GET request. Here's the route. So what's going to be the path of the request? And then it takes any parameters that you pass to the function and goes off and does whatever you need to programmatically. Then there are other things. If I go through and look at something like my email send is triggered via queue. So there's a queue trigger. And the queue trigger then declares what's the connection string of my storage account, what's the name of the queue, and then I'm casting this as a strongly typed object of effectively JSON that gets deserialized when it gets picked up from the queue, and then I can interact with that in whatever way that I normally programmatically would. So you're still writing code, but you're declaring these triggers, and you can have triggers for all sorts of other things like a new item in blob storage as well.
Okay, so obviously you've written the function, we've got it running in production, and now we've decided to come up with a better way to do it or to test a new variant of completing these functions. How do you manage this testing dev versus production? Can you give us an idea of, you know, okay, I want to improve this function and I want to make sure it works before I push it into production. I don't want to break anything. What sort of the process you go through to achieve that?
So it's a combination of things. I mean, there is a local dev experience. So obviously I dev everything on my local machine. There are emulators for the function service so I can execute and run those functions locally. From there, what I've been doing with both functions and the app service is using deployment slots. So in both those environments, what happens is every time I want to, let's say I want to test a new feature actually in Azure, I will commit into GitHub, push my code up to there. That will then trigger a deployment into a staging slot. So I have a Have I Been Pwned API function service. It has a primary slot and it has a staging slot. And the staging slot auto deploys that code. Now I can go and run whatever tests I want to in that staging slot, and nothing at all has changed in production. So I've got a bunch of integration tests which actually run against there remotely, so I can run through every scenario that I think needs to be tested and make sure it all comes back good. And then when I'm happy with that, I'm just swapping slots. So that there's literally a feature within Azure where you say, look, I would like to swap this slot and that slot. And it just simply redirects everything that would have gone to the production slot over to the staging slot, moves over any of your app settings that need to persist as well, because you're going to be talking to a different data repository. But what that means is that you have this really nice seamless switchover. You're not sort of trying to deploy code into a live running instance of a web server or Azure function or anything like that. So I'm not actually having outage during that rollover as well. So that's that makes it really neat. You can also configure that to auto swap as well. So if you sort of said, look, I'd like to push my code up to Azure and make it go live straight away, great. Let's actually do the same thing in terms of, you know, push it into GitHub, trigger a build, deploy that into a staging slot. As soon as it's deployed in the staging slot, then flick over and actually make the staging slot live, and then the live slot becomes a staging slot. And you can also have warm-up scripts as well, which says, for example, after a deployment, you know, perhaps hit this endpoint because this loads things into cache and I'd like to prime the site before it rolls over. So you've got quite a bit of configurability there.
Okay, so we've talked about obviously moving the infrastructure to the cloud. We've talked about the benefits of serverless and functions. But in your opinion, is there something that serverless won't work for? Is there something there that it will do well? Obviously with Have I Been Pwned, it works really well. But are there instances that you can point us to maybe that serverless doesn't make sense or may not be the best option?
Look, I think things like the site itself, I can't imagine running the website, certainly as it stands at present, as a function. And I'm sure there are people who say, well, look, you could actually just have an HTTP trigger for the root of the site, you know, or for the FAQs page or things like that. But, you know, they really still don't lend themselves as well to things that need views like we would have in a typical sort of MVC application. I don't think they're going to lend themselves at all to needing to load static assets like images and style sheets and things like that. And as much as people say you might be able to do this or that to hack around it, I think that that's just trying to make everything look like a nail to your Azure function hammer. One of the other things that I'm using extensively that also fits into the serverless paradigm is Cloudflare and their worker implementation. And that actually solves a bunch of these things that people may have tried to use functions to get away from, say, traditional app service for. So, a good example of that is pretty much everything on the website itself is cacheable. And what I do with Cloudflare is I say, look, I want you to really aggressively cache, say, the home page. So if I have the horde suddenly descend on Have I Been Pwned all in one go, I'm going to be serving that home page from one of Cloudflare's 150-something edge nodes directly from there to the user and not hitting my underlying service. And then when they do a search, yeah, they're going to have to hit Have I Been Pwned because they're searching through 5.5 billion records now. But now they're hitting a function. And what I'm doing is trying to just move as much as possible away from the app service, which is the thing which is expensive to run and the thing that's most likely to be overwhelmed by traffic. But Cloudflare's had a big role to play in that. And it's also, I mentioned Cloudflare workers. So Cloudflare workers are code on the edge. So those 150 plus edge nodes around the world can run your JavaScript to intercept requests and either modify the request or the response. And in fact, this is how I've been rolling over to functions. So I had published APIs for Have I Been Pwned where I went, hey, you can go to haveibeenpwned.com/API/blah, blah, 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 blah. If I want to roll that over into a functions that runs on a totally different domain, a totally different service, rather than telling people you've now got to go and hit another endpoint, I can use Cloudflare workers to get that request as it goes through the edge node. And it's still going to the old URL, but then I just redirect it. And I go, okay, look, go over here to the function instead. So I'm sort of using serverless on the edge in order to now redirect people to serverless on the origin.
Okay, so again, lots of benefits here. Obviously needs to be used again in the right instance. So for people who haven't experienced functions or want to learn more about serverless, I remember that back in the day you did a video on an introduction to Azure. You basically showed, I think, spinning up a website and WordPress, and that's sort of something that I watched, and then that made me definitely more interested and started to explore Azure myself. So on the serverless and the function side, you know, is there some good resources out there that you could recommend that people go and start their learning journey to move more towards what you've achieved?
I'm pretty sure there wasn't WordPress there. Let's just be clear, there's no WordPress. If anyone's interested in this, this is actually at worldsgreatestazuredemo.com. And this was actually quite some time ago now. In fact, it was the old Azure portal. I've just found the website here, and that the YouTube video there was published in 2014, March 13, 2014.
So yeah, like, and it was it was a fantastic video. And again, I certainly encourage people. It is the old portal, but the concepts you went through, the way that you presented it was, really, really absorbable, I suppose, I found, and it took away that mystique of what Azure was all about and worrying about and thinking it was too big to handle. So it is a really good demo for people to go and have a look at, even though it does, cover the older portal now.
So you know, the backstory to this, there's often a backstory behind a lot of the stuff I create. There's another ulterior motive or another agenda. And the agenda for this was that this was made at a time when I was back in my corporate role in Pfizer, and I was really trying to drive people towards Azure. We were still in very much an old shared hosting model where you had a VPS somewhere and all the sorts of dramas went with that. And every time I talk about it, people's eyes would sort of glaze over, and I was like, this all seems a little bit hard. And I just wanted to sit down and go, like, how can I make this seem just simple and consumable and just do a whole lot of stuff? So I pretty much just left the thing rolling. It goes for an hour and 22 minutes, and just recorded as many different things as I could to show all the different things we can do. And I think that's what sort of got up the traction. People have been asking recently if I'd do another one. I don't have the same reason to, I've freed of that corporate life. I don't have that necessity anymore. And there is a heap of material out there. There's an Azure tag on my blog where I've got loads of code examples, and I guess also just sort of examples of use cases of how I've applied the technology as well. So there's a heap of info out there.
So again, I'll certainly put the link in the show notes, but Troy's blog does have some very, very detailed information on obviously the journey you've gone through, the comparisons, the price, when you've actually worked it out to a business case and come down to a dollar term. So that is fantastic to have a look at. And obviously Troy's stuff on a regular update around security and stuff is something that you should subscribe to regularly and consume. But there have been some really key posts there that are certainly a long read, I will admit, but they are certainly worthwhile. And some of them are quite surprising when you come down to the conclusion that all of this I've just talked about cost me, $1.25 a month or whatever it ends up being, is really amazing when it's utilized correctly. So I'll point people to those specifically. But again, do you have just one resource? Is the Microsoft way to do it? Is the Pluralsight course maybe the way to have a look at it? Maybe something you've done?
I'm just trying to find a blog post because I want to leave people with one thing in terms of sort of raw hard numbers. But the best thing you can do is have a look at the So just for everyone's reference, it's first thing in the morning for me and I've got a bit of a cold and my head's a bit slower today. Have a look at the Azure tag on my blog. That's worth a look. And in there, you'll find a whole bunch of posts. There's one which I think is particularly interesting, which is called Serverless to the Max, Doing Big Things for Small Dollars with Cloudflare Workers and Azure Functions. And in here, I wanted to sort of demonstrate just how much you can do for very, very small amounts. And there's a pwned passwords feature of Have I Been Pwned where you can search through over 500 million passwords to see if one exists. There's a whole anonymity model around this. It's kind of cool. There's lots of stuff in the blog about this. But anyway, the sort of the headline numbers here is that I am supporting, when I did these numbers, 141 million queries a month of 517 million records. And it's costing me 2.6 cents a day to do it, which is just like, it's just kind of stupid, stupid money. But that's how cost effective you can be. They're just crazy numbers.
Well, I think that's, again, that's the real point I think that we need to, and I'd like to get across to people, for them to understand that things like Azure aren't expensive when done right. Now, of course, with any technology, you can do it wrong and it can be very expensive, but I think some of the stuff you've done and the way that you've documented out for people makes it very clear that it can be extremely cost effective, far more so than they've ever expected. And again, there's some really great info on there in those specific blog posts, but in your blog in general. And I believe that's at troyhunt.com. Is that correct? Is that the best place to send people?
Yeah, look, troyhunt.com, all roads lead from there, and my Twitter, which is at troyhunt.
Excellent. All right. Well, that makes it nice and easy for people to get the information, stay up to date with what Troy's done, and maybe petition him to do another video on introduction to Azure, since the last one was so good. And again, we appreciate the time that you've taken today. I know it's a busy day and you are a bit under the weather, and I'm sure there's a function that'll fix that for you, but just let you go away and write that. So to finish off, are there any sort of, you know, summary takeaways you would give the audience when it comes to obviously using serverless, and again, why you're sort of so excited and the benefits it provides you?
Yeah, look, I think if you start to think of serverless as a much fairer representation of what an application should cost, and what I mean by that is, let's start to think of this as, what does it cost to run your code? And then suddenly you start to think less about the logical boundaries of servers and how much memory you need and gigahertz of processors and things you need. And you start to think about, how can I decompose my code into small, easily executable units that I can run as fast as possible with as little overhead as possible. And that now has a direct line into your wallet, rather than this sort of really indirect thing of, if I run enough of them over a small enough period, then I'll scale up to something larger. Like, yeah, get rid of that thinking and try and start to move just towards executions of code. And suddenly things just get not only massively cheaper, but much, much easier to run and to write as well.
Yeah, I think that's a secret here. It's not only a cost thing, it's also the simplicity. It's also the make it more compact. And again, I think there's a lot of benefits that people would look at, because as with most IT, unfortunately, it tends to get a bit out of control. We tend to have a lot of stuff we don't need just because it's always been done that way. Revisiting, re-looking at it and reworking it can also provide, you know, cost benefits on top of simplicity benefits as well. So lots of information and ways to go about that in the space these days. So again, I know I want to let Troy get on with his day. I thank you very much for his time. I'm sure the listeners will also thank you very much for your continued appearance on the podcast. I'll make sure that those resources are available to everyone, and that I make sure that it gets out on the Twitter. But once again, Troy, thank you so much for your time and experience today.
No problems, mate. Thanks for having me back.
You have been listening to the Need to Know podcast from CIA Ops. For training on using technologies like SharePoint Online or Office 365, visit www.ciaopsacademy.com. By purchasing from the selection available, you'll be directly supporting this podcast. To provide feedback on this episode, visit www.ciaops.com/contact.